This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
You get down to the train platform and appreciate the cool wind or breeze or whatever you call the rush of air the train brings before it arrives, before you even see it or its lights, because of how much it cools your sweaty head.
That's a young writer named Tommy Orange, reading from his new novel, There, There.
You find a seat at the front of the train. The robot voice announces the next stop by saying, or not saying exactly, but whatever it's called when robots speak. The next station is 12th Street, Oakland City Center. You remember your first powwow. Your dad took you and your sisters, after the divorce, to a Berkeley High School gym where your old family friend, Paul, danced over the basketball lines with that crazy light step, that grace, even though Paul was pretty big, and you never thought of him as graceful before. But that day you saw what a powwow was, and you saw that Paul was perfectly capable of grace and even some kind of Indian-specific cool with footwork not unlike breakdancing, and the effortlessness that cool requires.
Tommy Orange's book is a remarkable debut novel about identity and belonging. He sat down recently with Deborah Treisman, The New Yorker's fiction editor.
So, yeah, I was not a reader. I didn't do well in school. I didn't really much care. I didn't really even have curiosity about most intellectual things. And then I became a musician, and I went to school for sound engineering and came out of that with no job prospects and got a job at a used bookstore. And
in Oakland?
It's right outside of Oakland in San Leandro.
Uh-huh.
And there was a moment I was on break from the bookstore, and I was parked outside of a donut shop eating a donut and reading Confederacy of Dunces. And I realized what the novel could do. And you know, in that moment, I knew I wanted to write one. And I wrote really weird stuff for a while that was not, I don't even know if you could call it fiction or nonfiction. Once I realized that I was going to include details about my own life, I think my writing changed and took on more form and moved away from experimentation.
And at some point, you found your way to the Institute for American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. And you did an MFA program there?
I did. I was about halfway through the novel at that point.
Uh-huh. And now you teach there?
I do.
Yeah. Was that your first exposure to other Native American writers?
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't read a lot of the Native canon because it was reservation-based, and it kind of made me feel less Native reading it. So I read a lot there, and I love it. I think a more important piece was feeling like I was a part of a community of Native writers. And there's a sense there that you don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to explain your culture, and everyone knows your context. So the freedom to write into something that's more particularly your voice, it's easier to access that because you don't have a lot of people that don't understand your experience at all. And this is for people of color in general. There can be a sense of, wait, you need to catch us up to where you're where you're going to start. And instead of having to do that, you can just sort of start where you want to.
The New Yorker published a chapter from the book back in March. And at the time, you told me that one of your main reasons for writing the book was that there were no novels out there about urban Native Americans. Why do you think that is?
Well, since then, I've been told by people that there are books. So I don't want to offend anybody by just saying I'm the only one that did it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find, you know, so it's they're not prevalent. I think it's related to a struggle for authenticity and feeling like you're Native enough growing up in the city. That's my only guess, is that there's a sense of not feeling like you're a part of something, so not feeling like you can give voice to something specific like that. And I think because most of the what's in books and movies is reservation-based, I think you don't feel like you're writing like a Native if you're not writing about the reservation.
Now, in your case, you grew up, you have a white mother and a Native American Cheyenne, mm-hmm. Arapaho father. Did people ever guess what your two cultures were? I mean, did they know?
Never guessed right. No, if I was in like the Fruitvale around a Mexican community, they spoke Spanish to me first every time. Mm-hmm. And in high school, I was called racial slurs for being Chinese. I never felt accepted in white spaces, and haven't really felt accepted in Native spaces either necessarily. I mean, now I am, and I worked in the urban Indian community in Oakland for many years, and I feel a part of it for sure. But people always wonder, this just happened just this week. I was doing a signing and people came up to me and said, "Are you Native?" And the follow-up question after I say yes was, and this is important, the well that comes before, "Well, how much?" And I'm like, you know, I get why people ask, because there's been a lot of fraudulent stuff, and people want the real thing. And but there's just so many gradations. There's a big range of what it can mean.
The format of the book is to tell the story of a whole kind of panorama of characters who have quite different voices, and they're told in different ways. The chapter we did is told in the second person. So at what point was that always the structure for the book in your mind?
I knew two things very early on, and that was I was going to have a bunch of Native lives converge at a powwow in Oakland, and that it was going to be multi-voiced or polyphonic or however you want to say it. And that is because we struggle against like a monolithic view of our culture, and what it means to be Native has meant one very old, tired thing. So I wanted to show the dynamic range. I wanted to write characters that were different ages and were into different things that have to do with pop culture, and wanted to try to do it in a modern way on purpose to resist that monolith.
There's, I won't give away the end of the book, which is a great sort of symphonic ending, but these characters do come together at the powwow, and there are a lot of things happening at the powwow. There's dancing, there's all kinds of arts happening sort of simultaneously. Is that what it's like? Have you been to one of these huge events?
I haven't been to the big ones because there isn't a big Oakland powwow.
Yeah.
There's a small one at Laney College, this junior college near downtown Oakland. But there is that going on. There's people make beautiful jewelry. They sell their art. They sell food. There's drums. There's dancing. It's a contest. You're trying to win money. I just thought it's a perfect microcosm for urban Indian life because it's intertribal. This is one of the things that makes urban Indian life different than reservation life, because usually on a reservation, you're one tribe. And people came to cities on relocation and started up families and met other people from other tribes and made kids who now you can't ask them to necessarily just identify with one.
And it's not attended by white people. It's not a performance of Indianism for sort of tourists.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you'll see white people with cameras and you get sort of a sense that, you know, you fear what their intentions are or how are they looking at us. But it's definitely not for non-Native people. It's for us.
Yeah. There's been some talk about the idea that there is a Native Renaissance in the arts these days. Do you see that around you?
Definitely. And you could attribute it to, you know, the pipeline that everyone saw visibly on TV, this horrific scene of people praying and getting shot by rubber bullets. And that bringing, you know, the idea that we're still here up for people. And you could talk about it as a reaction, a sort of counter reaction to Trump and all that he represents. Because he's very anti-Indian. He's been pretty open about that. I think these are all factors. I hope that the Renaissance isn't one of these waves, because it happened in the 70s and it happened in the 90s. I hope it's not just a temporary thing. I hope we can build something sustainable.
Do you see a lot of talent in the people you teach at the IAIA?
Yeah, there's a class just graduated with a ton of talent. Like, it made me feel like our class wasn't, you know.
You were the warm-up.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new program. It's only, I think, 5 years in. So it's coming into its own, and the students are, I think there's going to be a lot of good writing that comes out of it.
So you have some competition.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tommy Orange talking with Deborah Treisman of The New Yorker.
We are gathered here today for the wedding ceremony.
I'm David Remnick, and you got to get the champagne out now, because in a minute, we're going to a wedding.
There's any reason why this couple should not be married. Let them speak now or forever hold their peace.
It's the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I now pronounce you married. You may seal your vows with a kiss.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. You know, there's a job opening in Washington right now. It sounds like a terrific job with interesting colleagues and a lifetime tenure. They're already interviewing a candidate, but it might not be too late to throw your hat in the ring. Here's Paul Rudnick.
Application to be a Supreme Court Justice. 1. Why do you want to be a Supreme Court Justice? A. Job security. B. It will look good on Tinder, especially the photo in which I'm flirtatiously unzipping my robe just a bit. C. I enjoy riding jet skis, taking long walks, and telling women what they can and can't do with their bodies. 2. True or false? It's inappropriate for the personal religious beliefs of a justice to inform his or her legal decisions unless God tells that justice in a dream, "You're the only smart one. I mean, look around." 3. In cases involving powerful business interests, how will you balance the rights of an individual against the economic heft of a corporate giant? A. I'll think, well, when was the last time an individual offered me free 24-hour delivery? B. I'll ask the attorneys representing the corporate interests if Time Warner is really offering cocaine and prostitutes to try to lure customers back. C. I'll ask Justice Ginsburg, Ruth, is it worth getting Netflix when all I want to watch is Kimmy Schmidt and all the episodes of Friends? 4. Who or what is Merrick Garland? A. An exit on the Long Island Expressway. B. Not a Mexican. C. The best name for a riverboat gambler since Gaylord Ravenel. 5. If you're confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice, what would you like your legacy to be? A. He or she bravely remained on the court for 3 years after being declared legally dead. B. He or she was the first justice to sit on one of those inflatable exercise balls instead of a chair. C. He or she introduced a more egalitarian system of jurisprudence to the nation by concluding every decision with the words, or maybe not.
Application to be a Supreme Court Justice by Paul Rudnick, playwright, novelist, and New Yorker contributor for over 20 years. I'm David Remnick. We're going to finish up the show for today with a wedding. Now, weddings, especially summer weddings, bring to mind a scene that's so specific it's almost a cliche. The embossed invitation, the bouquets held by the young kids, the rice, the white tent, all following months of agonizing over every detail. But if you live in New York, where a catered meal of rubber chicken and maybe an asparagus could set you back a few hundred dollars per person, the quintessential wedding is a little different. It's a city hall wedding. You and your loved ones parade down to the municipal building, a huge skyscraper. You go through their metal detector, you buzz right through, and then you have a moment before a judge. It lasts no more than a moment. But Vincent Cunningham, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and his fiancée just did it, and it's a memory. Well, let him tell you.
I grew up imagining a wedding that would happen at a church, certainly by a pastor or a priest or something like that. The scriptures that I had always heard about marriage would be, like, you know, recited. You know, love is patient, love is kind, things like this.
I had not given much thought to what my wedding might be like.
That's Renee, my fiancée.
I just knew that I didn't want it to be big.
I think in the end we got married at City Hall because we'd been engaged for a long time. Neither of us had the stamina to plan something on a grander scale, and we thought that we could make this a lot of fun.
And so we went with that.
Yeah. So it's the day of our wedding. We are here early, and so it hasn't opened yet, but people are still like waiting in line.
We made it here.
Yeah.
We have a good spot in line.
Yeah. My mom's on her way. I'm like, outside is this like crazy bustle of people, these like lawyers headed to the courts.
Yes, sir. You're looking for a bouquet.
Flower guy selling flowers and a bunch of photographers looking for clients. It's kind of a madhouse.
Oh, you need a wedding bouquet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I got it right here. I got a white one. I can make another color. I got Kalalulu.
Tracking her car right now. My mom's on her way. She's telling me she's in the car, but I want to make sure she gets there in time so that we can all go through the metal detectors together.
Says 11 minutes. This feels like a very modern wedding problem. Like, let me look on the map where.
And meanwhile, I'm thinking in the back of my head that I don't want to cry in a couple minutes when this actually happens.
I couldn't go to sleep. When I fell asleep first, I was like, I don't think I really fell asleep until like 3:30.
To get married at City Hall is in some ways to acknowledge the fact that it really is a legal, contractual matter, right? It's totally not unique. Everybody's here to do the same thing that you're doing. Everybody is going to take a number in the same way that you are. So at the same time, it's very beautiful. It's very generic. Now I'm just like really wondering why people choose to get married here as opposed to other ways. What was the decision like?
I think this is the simplest way.
The simplest way?
You know, we are foreigners. They're trying to adapt ourselves into like a different area, like a different culture. So yeah, do something new, you know, different than what traditional people do all the time.
I mean, we're doing it sort of for practical reasons. Needs health insurance.
Yeah, I mean, this is more of a formality. It wasn't meant to be something that was super special. It's just supposed to be paperwork, but it still does feel kind of special.
You know, now it allows us to figure out being as a family unit, so we really want to think about how to increase that family unit with either kids or more dogs.
That was the first thing I thought of with Sadie. Our dog at home. And I'm like, well, now she'll have, you know, married parents.
Yeah, so.
So we've been friends for 16 years.
Yep. When Renee and I met, I found out very quickly, because I asked very quickly, that Renee had a boyfriend at the time. But I was always sort of trying. I kissed Renee once, I remember, on a subway platform, and she was like, it's, she was like still dating someone. It was inappropriate. And her lips did not move. And it was just like, we were friends, and then it was just like, okay, that, all right, fine. But you know what? I planted a seed that day.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
What is happening?
Fancy.
Oh, we're moving.
We're finally through the line, and we've got Renee's mother, my mother, Renee's brother, Renee's sister, and my daughter with us. And then at the end of the line, we're just... There's this metal detector.
They have like the airport magnetometers and stuff.
It's very TSA feeling, but you're in a dress and stilettos, or some people are wearing full-on gowns.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of an incongruous thing. I don't think many people think about getting checked for weapons on their wedding day. And then once you've given your ID and you've got this number, it's just the nicest DMV you've ever been in.
You know, it's like these sort of gold fixtures and big, portentous-looking lights, but it's still, like, the display of, you know, A65, pick up your tab, you know.
And there's also, like, a lady telling us to...
I don't even know how to describe her. She commanded the room immediately.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen!
Good morning!
Welcome to the marriage room.
Yeah, she's, like, half... half Catskills comedian, half like TSA agent.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Rule number one, no contraband. Rule number two, no contraband. Rule number three,
no contraband.
And she's also clearly seen a knife.
Yeah.
She's like, also no more, like out of nowhere, she's like, no knives here, please.
Are we ready? Steady, go.
Oh, okay, station line.
So we walk in, and there's a podium. At some point, the officiant just comes into the room.
It was these people's second.
Morning.
Renee and Vincent.
Yeah.
All right, come on up, you two. Are you guys exchanging wedding rings today?
We are.
All right, bring the rings up, please.
Thank you.
Face each other.
Okay. And she tells us to face each other and hold hands.
We were just looking at one. I was just like, we're staring at one another.
Yeah.
We're just like in this death stare. As I suspected, while I'm holding Renee's hand and looking at her, I'm also feeling my eyes start to sting.
We are gathered here today for the wedding ceremony of Renee.
It was. I don't mean to sound dramatic, but it was sort of otherworldly.
Yeah.
I kind of blacked out.
I did too.
Let them speak now and forever hold their peace.
What is so striking to me is that everything else seems so different than other weddings I've been to. Then all of a sudden you're up there and you're hearing and saying these things that you've heard at every wedding. Suddenly you're a player in this thing that is very much like a form that you've seen before.
Renee, do you solemnly declare that you take Vincent to be your spouse?
I do.
You promise to love.
Sometimes I guess you get worried about what makes something sacred and important. And it's strange, like, you realize that so many of the forms that you think take to contribute to that, all of it, all the sort of veils and lace and all of it, at the bottom of it are these sets of, like, very simple promises.
Do you solemnly declare that you take Renee to be your spouse?
I do.
Do you promise to love, honor, cherish, and keep her as long as you both shall live?
I do.
Please place the ring on her finger as a symbol of your promise.
Because you tend to see any kind of ceremony or spectacle, you tend to see from the outside in. You tend to think that the trappings of it are what give it its power. But standing in this room, you realize that there is a power in the thing itself. You know, deciding to partner yourself with someone for life, it really does kind of convince you, like, that is a tremendous thing.
Then by the power vested in me by the laws of the state of New York, I now pronounce you married. You may seal your vows with a kiss.
What was your name?
Alisa.
Alisa, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
rich with all the art right here. Everybody, get in here.
Vincent Cunningham, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we just heard from his new wife, Renee Chung. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Next week, Patrick Keefe brings us an extraordinary story about a notorious gangster in Amsterdam and the sister who decided to betray him. I hope you'll join us. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.